Today I chatted with Joan Neeson. She's a Sports Illustrated writer, recently moved over to their new vertical covering college football called Campus Rush. Joan was in town covering the Mizzou football program, trying to find out what's made them so successful in recent years. She's actually a graduate of Missouri Graduate School. So at the beginning of our conversation, she mentioned somebody named Greg. She's referring to Greg Bowers, who's the sports editor at the Columbia Missourian. He's also my boss. We don't talk very much about her upcoming story on Mizzou, but more about her career and kind of how she ended up at her quote-unquote dream job at, you know, the age of 26. So hope you enjoy the talk, and here's Joan. We're here with Joan Neeson from Sports Illustrated. It says on your little bio on SI.com that it's your, quote, dream job. So I'm curious, what drew you into sports writing?
Well, it's a tough question. I mean, I came to Missouri. I just came for grad school, and I was going to be a business reporter. I have an econ degree undergrad. But your first semester of grad school at Missouri, you do the Missourian. There's no, like, business beat at the Missourian because we're in Columbia. And so everyone said that Greg was cool and would make you a better writer and reporter, where everyone else was kind of hammering home on, like, reporting. And, I mean, I needed to learn how to report, but I also was, like, it was appealing to me that he was so focused on the writing side of things, and I'd always really liked sports. So I did Greg's beat the first semester, and then was like, all right, I'm going to go do business reporting now. And a friend of mine, who was also a sports writer, he was like, why don't you just keep doing this? This is a career you could have. And I don't think it had occurred to me that it was a career I could have until then, so I did.
Now, what you write now, it typically doesn't have a business bent, even. Has your business degree helped you in any way?
People think it's neat. I think, like, hiring editors think it's nice, but I don't think... I mean, I have a very analytical brain. I think it's part of why I was an econ major. I like math. I like numbers. I like when things add up neatly. So I think it informs, like, the way I look at stuff. But I'm sure I could do a story. You know, I'm well equipped to write a story on the business side of stuff. It doesn't interest me particularly, so I don't do a lot of it.
What kind of a sports fan were you as a child?
I love baseball. I grew up in St. Louis. My first, like, sports obsession was the home run race in 1998. I was 11, and just was, like, fascinated by it, and that kind of was my entry point into baseball. And it wasn't just the Cardinal. I mean, it was McGuire, obviously, but you had Sosa and you had Griffey, and so I was very into just baseball in general. I would scour, like, the page of the paper that has all the scores and all the statistics. I memorized batting average. It goes back to, like, the math thing and, like, the weird brain. I knew every Cardinals batting average every day. Like, I was very, very weird. I wanted to be the Cardinals manager. So,
but they were well equipped in that. They didn't need you.
Yeah, they had Tony La Russa by that point, I guess. So I think they were set.
Are your fondest childhood memories tainted after realizing that the home run race was?
Like, yes and no. I mean, I think there's a way to look at sports as a kid and a fan that, like, it doesn't have to be ruined. You just remember, like, those nights at the baseball stadium. And I never actually wrote the story because I was working at Fox Sports with a lot of freedom to do whatever I wanted, and then moved to the Denver Post sort of while I was doing this. And the Denver Post, I was covering the Broncos, so I didn't have as much freedom. But I wrote a story about the guy who caught number 62, I believe, who was a grounds crew member at Busch, and he was 18 at the time, I want to say. I think he was going off to college. And he gave the ball back to McGuire. He had a relationship with McGuire over the years, and he, as of 2 years ago when I talked to him, was a very successful lawyer in St. Louis who was still a member of the grounds crew because of his attachment he had to, like, that season and all of it. And so that's, like, my example that I give for that is he knows that it's all a pile of you-know-what, but he still, you know, has his attachment to, like, the magic that it was, and that's kind of how I feel about it.
You're at Campus Rush now. Can you explain exactly what that is?
So, yeah, that's part of my job at Sports Illustrated, is this new site. We launched, I mean, today is... We launched it, like, 3 weeks ago, I want to say, 2 weeks ago. It's a college football vertical, which means, you know, a website that's geared towards more... I think that's what vertical means, geared towards more, like, feature writing and, you know, less quick-hit type pieces. It's very similar to the MMQB with Peter King that we launched 2 years ago, except for that it's not built around a personality. It's built around kind of the experience of college football. It's still really taking shape, but it's going to be very feature-based. I'm going to be doing a lot of features. We have some writers who are doing sort of weekly or daily things, like you know, the insider read, which Thayer Evans and Pete Thamel have gotten very known for their, you know, dissecting of what goes on day-to-day in college football. And we have a woman, Lindsay Schnell, is going to be doing something on an interesting walk-on every week. So there's going to be weekly kind of bench post stories and then features. I know way more about the feature side of it, since that's sort of what I've been tasked with. And this is all sort of a complement to our college football coverage in the magazine.
How frequently are you supposed to write?
You know, it's still taking shape. I think in an ideal world, I will be reporting something every week, and then I think sometimes it'll look like I wrote three things in 1 week, and other times I won't have a story online for 2 weeks based on the way things time out. But for now, I'm pretty much going to be reporting something every week. I think, you know, in an ideal world, I'd be turning like a 2,000 to 3,000 word feature every 10 days. But I still have magazine duties and NFL various duties and online duties. So I think it's all, the way I'm being used is kind of different than a lot of people at SI, because I'm sort of branching NFL and college football, so I think everyone's sort of waiting to see what my role turns into.
Yeah, and you had a few of the scouting reports in the Sports Illustrated NFL. I saw that. Do you have a normal day, or is it just changes based on the week?
Yeah, I mean, it's reporting can be so many different things. I mean, usually there's days of traveling, there's days of reporting on the road, and then when I'm home, it's pretty much get up, go to the coffee shop, work there for as long as I can handle it, change venue to a different coffee shop, or go home, you know, write all day. I like to write at night, so sometimes it's something where I, you know, take care of something during the day for a little bit, and then go to dinner with some friends, and then get home at 9:30 and work till 1 also. So it's, I do a lot of work at, like, the extreme hours of the day, I think.
Now, you just got a new home in Chicago.
Yes.
Do you live alone?
I do.
Why do you feel the need to go to a coffee shop? Is it just you can't concentrate when you're in your own
home? I can concentrate. It's just, it's good to get dressed and go somewhere every day, I think. It's also, there's better, I think at times there's better concentration. I also like switching. I do work at home for several hours every day, but there's something to be said for switching up your scenery, I think. You can get way too bogged down and, like, wake up and sit there in, you know, your t-shirt and, you know, big boxer shorts that you wear to bed and, like, on the couch, and it's all of a sudden 1 o'clock and you haven't brushed your teeth.
Yeah.
And that's, like, not a lifestyle that I would suggest to anyone.
In what ways, so this SI was your dream job, in what ways is your dream job different than the way you dreamt it?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I say it was my dream job because I've always wanted, I wasn't a kid growing up being like, I want to work at Sports Illustrated. But once I got into this industry, I wanted to have the freedom to write really, you know, well-reported, thought-out, long-form features, and that's what I get to do at Sports Illustrated. So it's more the job in a way than the place, I would say, which is a better way to look at this industry because it changes so much. Like, know what you want to do, but not where you want to be.
Sure.
Because, I mean, who knows what Sports Illustrated will be in 10 years, and it's so different now than it was 10 years ago. So it's, you know, I think it's, that's a tricky industry in that respect. But I mean, as far as how is it different, I mean, I think with any job, I mean, there are those lucky people in this industry who write only, you know, beautiful long-form features that they have 3 weeks to a month to work on. And those people are like unicorns in this business. And I'm never going to be able to do that, nor is it a good thing to do, I think, for me. I think my mind, I get too obsessive about stuff. So I think I do a lot of little other stuff, you know, going to an NFL game and turning a web column on it, or like you mentioned, the scouting reports for the magazine. They're kind of, I don't want to call them brainless, but they're pages on every team that kind of break down their offseason and where they're going to be this year. They're not, you know, groundbreaking journalism, but that's all good to do to kind of keep your mind in the game.
So when you got done with grad school, you were an intern at Sports Illustrated and in the Dallas Morning News,
yes.
And then you were an NBA writer for the Timberwolves and Lakers?
Yeah, for FoxSports.com.
You're 24 at that time?
So I had just turned 24 when I started. Like, right, it was right after I turned 24, and I did that for 2 seasons. I really covered the Timberwolves. I moved to LA to cover the Lakers and Clippers. Did not like during the off season. I just didn't love the. It wasn't the same. It was a different location, different bosses, different structure.
Mm-hmm.
Got out pretty quick, so I pretty much covered the Timberwolves. Is what I would say.
What was it like being that young and just being thrown into an NBA beat?
I really lucked out on the team that I got to cover. It's a great media group. The guys who cover that team regularly are just, like, fantastic people.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a huge media group either. It was pretty much Jerry Zagoda from the Star Tribune, his kind of number two guy, Kent Youngblood from the Star Tribune, John Krasinski from the AP, and Ray Richardson from the Pioneer Press. And then those four were the people who were there every day. And people would pop in and out, obviously, but, I mean, And my job was such that I could have probably been there less because Fox was pretty loosely structured. But I basically was like, if Jerry's going to be at something, I'm going to be at something. If John's going to be there, I'm going to be there. And so I very quickly kind of ingratiated myself into the, oh, she's one of those guys who is here every single day.
Yeah.
And you know, it took time, obviously. I mean, I kind of started in the middle of Kevin Love's contract situation, and I was the last person on anything there, because they had all been cultivating that story for months, and it takes time to get into any beat, but it was a really manageable beat in terms of, like, the number of people on it, the fact that the people on it were not competitive, mean-spirited, anything like that, and the team, they weren't very good, but they had interesting young players, so I managed to, like, get a lot of good access, but also my stories did get read, because, you know, you see Kevin Love, Ricky, it was Ricky Rubio mania, so I had... It was nice in that respect. People did read my stuff, even though it was not a good team.
So what were your strategies for catching up? If you're behind on something, a story like that, how did you, you know, catch up?
I mean, in some cases I just didn't at the beginning. I just was behind. But I was thrown in at the very beginning. I start my first day, it was like the first game of the post-lockout season. So I did not have a lot of time to sort of get any footing at all. Mm-hmm. So I come right off an internship. It was not like I was sitting at home at my parents' house looking for a job and researching on the job I was applying for. It was very much like a, do you want this job? Okay, be here in 3 weeks. And the 3 weeks before I was there, I was finishing up my internship. So I was behind for sure. I read everything. I really, like, kind of fell in love with the NBA, so I did a lot of consumption of media about the NBA, I think, that first season. But it was pretty much the off season after my first season on the beat where I told my boss, I was like, this is a dead period, nothing's happening, I'm going to spend the week, like, studying up on the CBA and, you know, looking at all the background, studying, like, the team's history so that we'll bring up, like, an obscure player from the 90s, I know what they're talking about, and... You know, and he gave me the freedom to, during the off season, like, really, like, lock down on all of the kind of peripheral context you need to know to be on a beat and do it well.
Yeah. What was it like being a woman, and especially one of a small physical stature, being in the locker room with guys who were, you know, 7 feet tall? Was that at all physically intimidating, or did you just get over it pretty quickly?
I'm sure it was. It's something that has stuck with me because it's so routine now. I always laugh. People always ask me about that, and I say the worst, but in terms of physically imposing, just it being difficult, is NFL training camp, because you get guys coming off the field and so they're standing up. Well, yeah, there's that, but they're standing up, and so I'm 5'3". They're, you know, 6'2". Sometimes you can't hear them. You can't get your recorder up high enough. When you're in a locker room, guys are generally sitting, and you kind of sit next to them or you stand, and so it's less physically imposing than you would think in those scenarios, and guys get. I mean, they're not, it's 2015. I mean, it's, women are in locker rooms now, so guys behave accordingly. And, you know, in Minnesota, I was one of fewer women there. When I was in Denver covering the Broncos, there were two of us, Lindsey Jones and I, were in there pretty much every day. And so they were very accustomed to having women around, and they behaved accordingly.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. We're making progress in that regard.
Yes.
We were chatting yesterday about when you came to Missouri for graduate school, you were far more shy than you are now.
Yeah.
When did you break out of that? Was there a specific moment or a key time in your life?
I think when you're thrown onto a beat, you just have to get over it. But, I mean, I think it's still something that I improve on with every year kind of in the game. I think I get better and better about... At this point, I mean, I'm pretty comfortable in most situations. But I've always been the kind of person who, like, around friends and people I know well, I'm very outgoing and bubbly, but around strangers, I'm pretty reserved. I don't walk into a room full of strangers and immediately make friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably covering Missouri for the football for Greg here at the Missourian helped out a lot because you're in those situations. And then from there, you just kind of own it. I don't know. And I think the more you know about what you're doing, the more you know how the way the industry works, it just all goes hand in hand. You just feel like you're knowledgeable on the subject. And you realize these guys aren't. I mean, they may be celebrities, but they're just like, a lot of them are younger than me at this point. You know, they're...
A lot of the players?
Yeah, a lot of the guys in an NFL locker room are younger than I am, or they're my age, and you learn to, like, talk to them about, for instance, when I was covering the NBA, I learned very quickly that pro athletes love talking about college sports, and so you talk to them about your March Madness pools, and you just, once you've proven to them that you're a regular person, then the conversations become much easier.
Hmm. You used to be a beat writer, of course, you mentioned covering the Broncos, and now you... off have the parachute in.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is it to adjust to that, and what are your strategies when trying to do a story that you're not necessarily as well-versed as you would be if you were on the beat?
I mean, you have to do a lot of research going into it. It's a really bad feeling to show up for a story and not have done your research. And it happens based on, like, just a story popping up and you going there and you didn't have time. I mean, if it's something where go there tomorrow and do that, I mean, it's going to happen to the best of us. But, you know, it's a terrible feeling. So you've got to do your research. I also try to be very, you know, either you have the bad side of it is you're not, the guys don't know you, you don't know the ins and outs of the locker room. The good side of it is working for a place like Sports Illustrated or ESPN or somewhere like that, you there's the name recognition that the PR staff is going to give you good access. So a lot of times you have one-on-ones with guys, and so you're not in a situation where you're in a scrum fighting to get your voice heard with a bunch of strangers who are also asking questions. So that helps. But there's the converse, is you have to be really mindful as, like, the national person swooping in. Because when you're on a beat, you don't. There are certain national people who come in who you don't like.
Because
you monopolize players. So there's a way to do it where you're not, where you don't. Like, there are certain people who've been swooping in forever and are great. Mm-hmm. But you just have to learn how to, you know, not... There are some beat writers who are always going to be ticked off because they're turf and they're very proprietary about it, and that's that. But I think there are ways to go about it. You know, if you see a local guy, you've been talking to someone who's a big name player for 10 minutes, you see the local guy lurking over your shoulder, just like let him in eventually, maybe wrap it up, or let him co-interview for a little while. There are certain ways to do it. People are always going to be annoying about it, but I just try to as much as I can, and teams are good about this. I love going somewhere and, for instance, getting guys at a time the rest of the media isn't there, or, you know, getting someone in their office beforehand. So, like, there's not people lurking and getting upset that you're there because they don't even know you're there.
You mentioned researching a lot. What are your strategies? Where do you look?
Just kind of read everything.
Just go online and read?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, like, Google search. It's not rocket science. A lot of Google searches. Also, we have a Nexus subscription at Sports Illustrated, and that's, you know, every news story ever is on Nexus. So for some stories, you know, for some, something like, okay, I'm here right now doing a story on Missouri. That's a Google search for me. Like, I mean, yeah, I went here, so I follow them. But even then, I don't know the ins and outs. I don't know. I mean, I like to look at pictures, you know, what guys look like, that, especially football players. I was doing this Missouri story yesterday, and they brought someone up to me, and I was like, I watch this team all the time. I don't know who this is. And so I'd be like, I am so sorry. Who are you? And that's, like, not a position you want to be in, but sometimes you are. It's these are guys who wear helmets when you watch them play, and you're not around, and you swoop in. But, yeah, I mean, Google search, Nexus search for more complicated stories, and for stories that really have research that goes back more than 5 years, I would say, you really want to go to Nexus or go to some kind of database where you can search dates and better parameters to get, you know, a wider range of stories.
In terms of source development, have you found it easier or tougher in your position now at SI?
I mean, it's harder in the sense that you're not around anyone a lot, but it's easier in the sense that I mean, I think it's easier for me just because I've developed as a writer and reporter. I'm just getting better at that kind of stuff. As a woman, it's sometimes tough to ask for phone numbers, and I used to be very, very shy about that. I never wanted to, like, anyone to possibly think. And it was me projecting onto myself. Like, I've never behaved in a way that anyone think I was asking for their phone number for any other reason, but you just worry. And I've gotten more comfortable with just being like, hey, man, like, can I get your number, too, in case I have a follow-up? And that's that. It's also, in that sense, it's kind of easier to collect phone numbers because if you're on the beat and it's like, hey, man, can I get your phone number for follow-up? They'll be like, well, I'm going to be here tomorrow, and so are you.
Yeah.
If they don't want to give you their number. Whereas if it's me and I'm in, you know, City X, hey, man, can I get your phone number for a follow-up next week if I'm going through and transcribing this and I need some? Oh, yeah, sure, cool, no problem. So it's interesting in that respect. It's easier to develop sources, too, in the sense that you get one-on-ones with people more, and so they get an impression of who you are more, in terms of not just, like, a face in the crowd. You get to spend 10 meaningful minutes with someone and show them that you're, you know, a thoughtful person who knows what they're talking about. That helps as well.
Has a source ever gotten the wrong idea when you ask for a phone number?
Not really, no. No, I don't think so.
I don't know if you followed the Emilio Reyno story at Minnesota.
Yeah.
Have you ran into any roadblocks or any, I guess, instances like that that kind of made it more difficult because you're a woman?
Nothing to that effect. I mean, when I lived in Minneapolis, I knew Amelia a little bit. We have some mutual acquaintances and friends, and she's a great reporter and writer, and got stuck in a really, really bad situation. I've never had anything to that extent. But yeah, I mean, there's times when it's, you don't want to talk to a guy because you know certain things and he's behaved certain ways towards you. I don't want to name names or anything. But yeah, I mean, it's a thing. And but there are good parts of being a woman, too. I was saying, just talked to Gary Pinkel for a bunch yesterday, and he was so relaxed and open. And I think sometimes guys get that way around women because we seem more trustworthy or something, which, I mean, that's a load of, you know what? I mean, I'm no more trustworthy than a guy on any beat, but that's that.
What's the favorite story you've written?
I mean, my favorite is probably the last big thing I wrote. It was, I did a story on the 10-year anniversary of Katrina and, the Tulane football team and sort of their season in exile. It just meant a lot to me personally. New Orleans is kind of my second home and my whole family went to Tulane and I've always known their story. I think it was a story a lot of people knew about. They played an entire season on the road and lived in a condemned dorm at Louisiana Tech. And it was just a very, I mean, I think the coaching staff lost its mind. It was a very rough semester. And I think it, the guys came out of it, you know, different. And it was, I mean, so did everyone from Katrina. But it was a fun story to do in the sense that I was very invested in it. The guys I talked to were all, like, fantastic people who it really seemed like it had this very traumatic experience 10 years ago, and it had made them into, like, better men in some ways. So it was a fun one to do. I fun is a bad word, but
yeah,
I was very invested in it, and it was received better than I expected, and that was nice.
Aside from it just being an interesting story, what did you do that you felt that made it better?
This is what one of the... So a couple of the guys who were in the story I've kind of kept in touch with since then, they're not really athletes anymore. A couple of them played in the NFL and have retired, and a couple of them, you know, were done after college. And same thing, I said, you know, what's your number so I can follow up? I had to follow up with a few, and some of us have gone back and forth because I'm in New Orleans a lot and we know some of the same people. And one of the guys said to me, you know, a lot has been written about Katrina, New Orleans sports in the past week. And he said, you know, first of all, you know the city. And people in New Orleans had a really hard time, I think, with a lot of the Katrina coverage from national outlets because people were coming in and, like, not really lending much nuance to the place or even giving a sense of place, which there is no more unique place in the world, I don't think. And he also said, you know, there's this temptation, the guy I was talking to, same guy, so there's a temptation to, you know, we all ended up okay and we all say we would do it all over again. So there's this temptation to gloss it over and make it be this, you know, team-building experience that, you know, got our program on better footing. The program is on better footing. It has a nice new stadium on campus, things like that. And he was like, you really pointed out that this was a lot of crap. And we, you know, we struggled, and it was hard, and it wasn't fun, but it was okay in the end. And I got some good affirmation from that, because it's hard to know, you know, it's hard to draw the balance there between, you know, making it this uplifting story and making it this depressing story. And he said, you know, I got the right balance of uplifting and depressing, I guess.
What are the benefits to covering a story after the dust settles? In this case, a full 10 years.
Oh, I mean, people will talk more. They'll say things that they never would have said right away. They have time to process it. I think that's a big part of it. You know, these guys who I talked to for that story, they were between the ages of 18 and 22 at the time. And now they're between the ages of 28 and 32. And so I think, I mean, they were kids and they made choices and they lived through something that no one should ever have to live through. And they've had a lot of time to reflect on that. And in this sense, it was nice because they all came away from it with, they came back to the city, they rebuilt, they put a lot of themselves into the story in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other things where people don't want to talk about it after time. Time, they've erased it from their memory, and that can be tough when it's something you just don't want to talk about. And I faced that with this story. I had people tell me they didn't want to talk to me because they didn't want to think, they didn't want to dredge it all up again. And so that can be hard.
I guess in the last year or two, are there any pieces of advice or anything you've learned that's really helped you as a reporter?
I've learned a lot in the last year or two, I would say, going from a beat writer to kind of a national writer, I guess you would call me. I don't know what you would call me. I mean, I think I touched on a little bit the balance between not upsetting the beat people when you come in. I think that is really good advice for anyone who's in this industry and has sort of higher-reaching aspirations to get, you know, off a beat. And, I mean, there are a lot of people who want to be a beat writer, be beat writers forever, and that's a great way to make a living. And if you love sports and all that, then you don't have to worry about this, but there are other people who want to, you know, look at big picture stuff. And I would say that's one piece of advice. I would say another piece of advice I would give is that, especially if you're coming out of a place like Missouri with a guy like Greg Bowers, you know, you develop a voice. And I think that's something that having a voice gets you, you know, up the ladder in this industry. And there are times when your voice will get edited out and your voice will get neutralized in a story. And it just happens sometimes in the editorial process. And when it's happened to me, I think at first I would just be like, it's fine. They just didn't like my voice. And then I had a conversation with a very high up editor at Sports Illustrated who said to me, you know, I thought that story, your voice was really just not there. And I was like, oh no, they edited my voice out. Mm-hmm. And so I think you need to stand up for yourself and your voice. I mean, editors should not be seen as, like, I guess they're authority figures in some ways. They should be seen as collaborators when you reach a certain level. They're trying to make your story better. You're trying to make your story better. And you need to work with your editors, and in a respectful way, obviously, and have a good, I mean, my editors, some of them I consider friends. Like, you have a good working relationship, but don't just take everything as fact. Sometimes, you know, hold on to what's valuable to you and your stories. And sometimes that stuff isn't valuable to anyone else and you have to get rid of it. But other times, you know, stand up for what you think with your stories.
How did you develop your voice, and how would you describe your voice?
I have no idea. I have no idea how
Other
I developed
than fast.
It. It's very fast. I talk very quickly. That's going to change. I'm going to remedy that. Everyone tells, when I was hired at Sports Illustrated, everyone said, you know, it's a big part of the voice in your writing. I don't really know how I would describe it, to be honest. It's just me. I like my stories to be, I don't even know. I mean, I would like them to be conversational in a way, or, you know, not academic or stilted or anything like that, obviously. I don't really know. I couldn't say it. And as far as developing it, I think a lot of it was just starting off from here, from Mizzou. I think Greg is very good at cultivating that. Greg doesn't want you to write a game story like everyone else. He doesn't want you to, you know, be one of anyone. He always tells you to try something. He'll pull you back. And I was lucky enough along the way to have a lot of editors who, even when I was on beats, allowed, you know, sometimes when you're on a beat, your voice goes away and you become very formulaic. And I don't think I like sports enough to have my voice go away, because I never was so into, like, the nitty-gritty stuff, which probably made me a bad beat writer in some respects. But I think that was it, especially when I was at Fox Sports. I had a great editor named Dan Graff, he didn't want me to be just like every other beat writer. When I was at the Denver Post, I think it was harder sometimes. Newspapers have a very formulaic, but I still managed to just write the way that I write and not let anyone, I mean, obviously if everyone was hating it, I would have changed, but it was going okay, I guess.
Does it even come from, like, the books you read, the TV shows you watch?
Oh, I'm sure it does. I think everything informs it. I think it's just who you are as a person. I think sense of humor informs it, you know. I think your voice also comes from getting very comfortable with your subject, too. I think it's something where, I mean, you don't want to take on their voice, but you want to take on the voice of the story and allow, you know, the story to inform your voice as well. And I don't think you can do that unless you are pretty, you know, invested and enmeshed in the story.
Yeah. And we were talking a little bit yesterday about just kind of having a life outside of journalism. How do you make sure that you're doing that and you're, you know, growing as a person aside from as a writer, in which might also inform your writing?
I mean, it's hard, and I didn't for a long time. My job is my life, was my life. It can be bad. I mean, it can be bad in a lot of ways, but the older I get and the more, I mean, Sports Illustrated is a place where, yes, they're going to work you hard, but they all understand that you need to be able to be given some freedom, and you need to, you know, they don't bother you when you have your time off and things like that, which is good. And I've sort of taken that, and I start to realize, you know, sometimes I need to not turn on the game and instead, like, go out on a date or do something like that. And that's good. I really like to read. I've always loved to read. And for a while, I read, like, only sports books. And I try to read two non-sports books, every sports book, and not garbage books. Because I think as a writer, I mean, you're a sports writer, but you're just a writer when it comes to it. Reading good writing, whether it's about sports or about fashion or whatever, is that it's the writing that's valuable, not the subject. And so that's a big part of it, too.
What have you recently read?
All the Light We Cannot See, which won the Pulitzer this year, which was amazing. I just finished something. I'm, like, slogging through Game of Thrones, which is not good writing and should not inform the way that I do my job. I've just started Kent Babb's book on Allen Iverson, so that's, like, the exception to the non-sports rule. But I'm really excited about that one, because Kent is a great writer, and I went to Georgetown undergrad, and Allen Iverson did too, so, you know, we're bunched in that way, me and Alan.
He's a friend of the blog. I told him when I talked to him that I haven't gotten to it yet, but it's like my first book on the list of things I need to read.
It's good so
far. I don't have time for yet.
And what else? I just finished something else, but I can't for the life. I just gave it to someone. I don't know. I'm going to read Aziz Ansari's book after Ken Babb's.
On dating, right?
Yes.
There you go.
For my book club. But it looks awesome. So, yeah, I like to vary it more than I used to and just not think about sports all the time in my time off or about writing. I think it's important, too, to have friends who aren't, I mean, I have a lot of great friends who are in the industry, but have friends who aren't in the industry as well.